Summer holidays are on the horizon, and if you're anything like me, you have stacked your schedule with a lot of time in the great outdoors. I am personally hoping to squeeze in at least one overnight hike, maybe an outdoor climbing expedition. If I'm really lucky, maybe a day or two out on the water in my kayak. But one thing that should be on your radar and mine is worst case scenarios in adventures like these. It's not something you want to dwell on, but preparing for all possibilities can literally be the difference between life, death, or being extracted by a specialist rescue team. So how prepared are you to venture into the wilderness? And are the systems in place to rescue you ready for peak season? In a tick, you're going to hear from someone who's led search and rescue teams, as well as someone researching the way we behave when we're lost in the wilderness. But first, Dr. Joe Kippax is an emergency doctor and the 2026 Tasmanian Australian of the Year. He was part of a specialist team who rescued a whitewater rafter trapped in rapids on Tasmania's Franklin River. Joe, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning.
Joe, you've told this Franklin River rescue story probably a million times now, but would you mind just giving us a little recap?
I'm going to try and sort of condense about 24 hours into about 3 minutes. Look, there was a Lithuanian group, very experienced bunch of guys, and they were doing the Franklin River November last year, and they had a really unexpected mishap. Their leader, Valdas, slipped and fell while scouting the bank of the river. They were trying to get their boats and equipment through a particularly difficult rapid called the Coruscates Rapid, and he slipped and fell, and really unexpectedly, unbelievably, he got his knee really firmly wedged between two enormous boulders with a lot of water sort of flowing onto him and forcing that position. So then there was just this enormous and escalating rescue effort that sort of started off small but snowballed into, you know, one of the biggest rescue efforts ever seen in Tasmania. And there were immense efforts overnight to try and get Valdas out of that situation using, heavy lifting equipment and hydraulic presses and pulley systems. All of that failed, and he was getting weaker and weaker. He was getting colder, and it was pretty clear he wasn't going to survive much longer where he was. And so it boiled down to the only option being an amputation of his leg to get him out, which that was only the beginnings of his problems, because when someone's in the water and very hypothermic, then it's quite likely they're going to deteriorate. And as he expected, as soon as Valdas was extricated from his trap position, he had a cardiac arrest. And so then there was the business of trying to resuscitate somebody and provide continuous CPR while trying to fly them out of there, winch them out of there, and then fly them to hospital. So it was an enormous undertaking, and, you know, such an amazing result that he survived and done very well.
I mean, we can talk about this knowing in retrospect that he survived, you did an amazing job, you're Tasmanian of the Year now, like, congratulations. But in that moment, what are you feeling?
In that absolute moment? Well, it's a very focused moment. Mm. It's not completely out of the blue. It's a very, very rare procedure, amputation, but it is something that we train for. And, you know, prepare for and have the equipment for. So it's definitely part of the armamentarium of you know, resuscitation and extrication. So most of it's sort of, you know, frantically thinking back to, you know, the training experiences you've had, and then trying to modify that for the situation you're in. And of course, this situation was different in that it was underwater. You couldn't see what was happening. It was a very awkward stance. And, you know, with a very, very sick person who we knew was going to get worse as soon as he was extricated. So it was lots of challenging little elements to it. But mostly you're thinking, what next, and what could happen next, and what am I going to do if that happens?
Mm. How many people are involved in a rescue operation like this?
Huge number of people. There's a huge number of people involved, you know, literally sort of probably something like 60 or 80 people altogether. And on the ground, there was probably about just a bit under a dozen people at varying stages. But, you know, everyone's doing sort of a crucial role. You've got the flight crews and pilots and engineers and refuelers sort of keeping the machines going. There's an immense amount of logistical organization in the background to keep all of those supplies flowing, and the coordination. And on the ground, you've got different agencies working together. You've got Tasmanian Police, you've got Ambulance Tasmania, you've got the AMSA aircraft up in the air, you've got the Whitewater Rescue Team. So there's lots of different teams working together and lots of individuals working together. So it becomes a very big thing quite quickly, and a very complicated undertaking quite quickly.
And you're in a really remote area. You're in a place that is by nature dangerous, because the reason you're there is because someone has already got into trouble. You put yourself in harm's way to help extract someone else. How are you or the dispatchers weighing that risk?
Look, I think that's a really good point. I think, you know, when you say it's risky, I think there's an immense amount of effort and thought and planning that goes into making it as safe as absolutely possible. And that's always, the safety of the rescuers has always been weighed up against, you know, the likelihood of success. And so, you know, everyone's actually going to a lot of effort to make it as safe as possible. And really, when things become unsafe, that's really a failure of planning. You know, usually that's when something unexpected happens. So, you know, I guess I'd argue that really with a well-trained team, you know, the absolute danger is probably overstated.
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting at is the fact that we go out, if you're an outdoorsy person, part of the attraction of going out is a little bit of the danger. It's a little bit of the risk and pushing yourself to a limit. If you've had to go out to rescue someone, it means that someone, somewhere, something has gone wrong along the lines there. And some people, not everyone, certainly not Valdis and his team as very experienced rafters, but sometimes the reason that people like you are being called out is because people have gone out underprepared.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the beauty of the wilderness, isn't it? Is the unexpected nature of things. We certainly encourage people to be, you know, as prepared as they possibly can and as informed as they possibly can. But, you know, sometimes things go wrong, as is the case in this particular rescue. But, you know, we certainly knew that with this particular team, they're well equipped. They had the communication gear to call for help. You know, they tried to mount a rescue themselves, but quite quickly they worked out that wasn't going to be effective, and they called for help. So, you know, hats off to that team for doing all the right things along the way.
Absolutely. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Dr. Joe Kippax. He's an emergency doctor, the 2026 Tasmanian Australian of the Year, and he's the doctor who performed the amputation that you may have heard of on a Lithuanian whitewater rafter last year, an incredibly difficult, complex rescue attempt. Because we are talking about heading out for summer. The numbers of people heading outdoors is increasing. We love to see it. Get out there and enjoy nature, but with it comes some risks. Jennifer in Canberra says, please tell listeners they should always take a whistle. When you're lost, it's easier to blow than to keep shouting. Make sure someone knows where you're going and your expected return. Another text says, my wife and I met a French tourist who was about to go on a hike near Bobbin Head in the Aussie summer of 2010. She didn't have a large water bottle or a hat. We gave her a brim hat, a water bottle, as we went kayaking. We shared details before she set off. It wasn't until the next day she messaged us with photos of her in a rescue chopper as she'd gotten lost and dehydrated in the Aussie bush. This person finishes by saying, incredible that people go hiking without any preparation. Well, also with me here is Dr. Jim Whitehead. He led the search and rescue team with Queensland Police for 17 years, and now he trains search and rescue coordinators across the country. And Crystal Dacey, a PhD candidate, looking into the way we behave when we're lost in the wilderness. Jim, I might start with you. Just step me through the process. If you're lost, but you have mobile reception and you call 000, what happens on the other end of that call?
Generally, if you have mobile reception, then the 000 caller can actually identify where you are through a GPS on your telephone, and they can activate or send it to the police, because the police are responsible for all land search within Australia, and then we can initiate a search with the resources that are closest to the incident.
And then if you don't know where you are, how do you communicate what you need?
Well, basically, it's a little bit of situational awareness. And when you go, bushwalking or other outdoor activities, you really have to be aware of the environment you're in and understand where you're going, how to get there, the difficulties, the time it will take to do that, and that sort of stuff. But I did hear before that one of the biggest things you should do is tell someone responsible what you intend to do and when you intend to come back. That way, if you don't make it back, then the alarm can be raised for you.
So that's if you can call 000. If you've got a personal locator beacon, is it a different process with search and rescue?
Absolutely. A locator beacon actually activates or talks to a satellite. There's a constellation of 32 search and rescue satellites around the Earth there. And a beacon, once you turn the beacon on, it will identify where you are down to within, 50 to 100 metres. And that call goes to the Australian Maritime Safety Authority in Canberra, and then they will send it to the appropriate authority to mount a rescue. So we actually have a very good idea where you are. The trouble with beacons of all sorts is that it doesn't actually tell us what the problem is. It just tells us that there is a problem and here is where the problem is.
Crystal, you're researching something called lost person behaviour. What is this?
Hi, Tegan. So when a person is lost, they tend to exhibit some kind of statistically significant behaviour. So there's lots of different things that we can see that lost people do. And this has been all over the world. There's a guy out there, Dr. Robert Kester. He has founded this, and Jim has also worked on this for the Australian context. And it's just going, looking at past events, lost events, and finding consistencies amongst the behaviour of these lost people. So this is things like route travelling. So that's when a lost person, when they figure out that they're lost, they'll go back on the route they came, or they'll find a path and go directly on that path. There's also direction following. So if you're aware of where you need to go, what cardinal direction, you might go ahead in that direction until you find something significant, something familiar. Mm-hmm. There's also things like view enhancing, where you'll travel up a hill and try and find something familiar, or try and orientate yourself to the mountains or try and find something familiar. And then, of course, the staying put, where a person will realise they're lost and they'll just stay where they are and wait for rescue.
And so how do you override that part of your brain if you're trying to make a decision when you are out and lost?
So my research looks more specifically, rather than the lost person behaviour that's currently used in search and rescue, is more activity based. So if you're a hiker, you're likely to do this. If you're a hunter, you're likely to do this. Whereas my research looks more into demographics. So say if you're a person with a lot of hiking experience, you're more likely to travel off track. Some may think that you're less likely to get lost, but, when taking into account the fact you are traveling off track, there's higher risk in that. That can lead to getting lost. I also look at the age of people. So older people tend to spend more time in national parks, but they are less likely to get lost. And that also comes down to risk-taking behaviour. So there's lots of different instances of different people doing different things. And, it's hard to put a blanket over everyone and say this is what everyone's going to do when they're lost. But there are some consistencies in different demographic factors that we can find.
Jim, just listening to that, I'm thinking about the fact that mobile coverage is so much more consistent and reliable than it used to be. People, maybe there's better technology around personal locator beacons and that sort of thing. Do you think it's changed the way people navigate outdoors and how far they push themselves?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I feel, and I think if we did studies on it, we'd probably confirm it, that with the advent of more handheld devices, mobile telephones, GPSs, beacons, and with the advent of far better equipment, as in motor vehicles and that sort of stuff, I think we tend to do a little bit more now than we would have done in the past, and it probably gives us somewhat of a false sense of security that I have all the devices so I can do something that I wouldn't have done, say, a decade ago. So I think in some cases it puts people in more trouble than they thought they would be in. But in other cases, it probably actually saves them, and we probably never know about those ones. But on the whole, I think it gives people a little bit of Dutch courage and allows them to experience some of that more thrills of the risks involved in travelling in a great country.
Here on the ABC Radio National, you're listening to Life Matters. You're hearing the voice of Dr. Jim Whitehead. He's trained search and rescue coordinators across the country now. I'm also speaking with Crystal Dacey, a PhD candidate looking into the way we behave when we're lost in the wilderness, and Dr. Joe Kippax, an emergency doctor, 2026 Tasmanian Australian of the Year, involved in pretty hectic outdoor rescues. A couple of stories on the text line that are striking a little bit of fear into my heart. One person said, I camped alone on the edge of a remote forest in Sweden. Decided to do a quick 1 kilometre nature trail before dark. At one point, I somehow joined a long trail and near dark contemplated staying the night in a dark hut. Then retraced my steps and finally got back to the car, very shaken. Quickly made a hot meal and went to bed. I'm much more careful everywhere now. Another person says, we ended up spending a night out in Canungra after the old walk out of a canyon had been overgrown. We had maps, personal locator beacons, and prepared to spend a night and backtrack and find a different way out the next day. Used the PLB to let family know we would be out for the night. Their response was along the lines of, have fun. However, the campsite people called rescue on us when we didn't return at the end of the day. When we made our way out the next day, we had a helicopter over our heads 20 minutes from the car park full of rescue, etc. Unnecessary in this case, but can understand why campers raised alarms. And Chris says the rescue and medical expenses cost the taxpayers of Tasmania $1 squillion. Chris says international rafters, etc., should have appropriate travel insurance. Jim, who pays for this sort of search and rescue apparatus?
Anywhere in Australia, if the search and rescue system is activated, it's a zero cost to the person who's in trouble. It's generally the taxpayer who foots the bill for almost everything. Some groups such as the SES, they're volunteers, so they give their time willingly, but you know, to use a rescue helicopter, to use a rescue vessel, all costs money, and generally it's all paid for by the taxpayer ultimately through levies or through donations or through individual government agencies that provide the service.
Joe, have you seen an increase in the number of people needing to be rescued in Tassie?
Yes, I think we have been seeing an increase. We certainly see a seasonal increase over the summer months when there's much more people sort of enjoying the outdoors. Gradually over time, there has been an increase. There probably has been a change in people's threshold for calling for help. You know, it's a complicated issue. We certainly don't want to discourage people from calling for help. And, you know, we've seen some bad outcomes with people who haven't activated the PLB and have, you know, there's been bad outcomes because of it.
Mm. When you say there's been a change in the threshold, do you mean people are less likely to want to call or more likely?
We get the impression some people are more likely to call. We've certainly had cases where people have been well outside of the comfort zone. Perhaps they've been less experienced, we think there's a phenomenon of people getting onto relatively difficult tracks and areas, perhaps of being influenced by what they're seeing online. And I guess if they're seeing pictures of people on a sunny day with minimal equipment, then there's a temptation to think, well, if they can do it, I can do it.
So is social media driving this rise in people heading out into the wild underprepared, do you think?
Oh, look, it's difficult to say that with certainty, but yeah, I think there's a suspicion that's part of the picture, yes.
Crystal, what kind of information would you like to be sort of seeing people receiving before they head outdoors to help them be prepared for how to help themselves if they get into trouble?
I think one of the main things is something that Jim touched on with the mobile phone usage and the way that people nowadays will just go out there because they have their mobile phone, because they have the route plan. And yes, a working mobile phone does decrease the time that a person is lost, but there's also a lot of issues that come with mobile phones in the sense that you go out, you've left it on, you're out for like 6 hours and your phone goes dead and then you're in trouble. There's a lot of research around the spatial cognition and navigation area looking at the fact that young people especially are just losing navigation ability because they just rely on their phones and they'll just blindly follow where their phones are telling them to go. Mm. So when we have that ability, that's great. And, you know, that can get people out of bad situations. But if you lose that ability because your phone goes dead or you lose your phone is broken, then that can cause a lot of problems. So, you know, definitely if we could all go back to the old school of being able to use a map and a compass and knowing our cardinal directions and where the sun rises and sunsets, I think that would be a really good benefit for not only preventing these types of incidents or reducing these types of incidents, but also, you know, in our day-to-day navigation, even around towns and cities and driving and things.
Joe, what do you wish people knew before they headed outside?
Oh, look, I think we can do a lot with the amount of information that's available. You know, there's a huge amount of information out there, but it's often quite scattered. I'd love to see, you know, greater facility for pulling together all the information, the track notes and the up-to-date weather forecast and perhaps recent track conditions, and, you know, advice on what to take, you know, all in a sort of an accessible format. There's, the information's out there, but it's often scattered all over the place and it's hard to access.
Jim, you train search and rescue coordinators, but I wonder whether sometimes you wish you could just train the general public as well. What kind of education do you think we should have out there?
I would tell people to do some research on what the activity is that they want to do. Research the bushwalking track, talk to national park rangers, talk to the people who are near the track. But the biggest thing I would encourage people to do is buy themselves the beacon, a PLB, register it. That way you can log a trip intention on the AMSA website. Also tell someone responsible where you're going to and when you expect to be back. And the greatest cause of personal stress, I suppose, is lack of water in Australia. So take water with you. So if you do those three things, you probably limit the chances of you getting yourself into trouble.
Good advice, Jim, Joe, Crystal. Thank you all so much for joining me today. Dr. Jim Whitehead trains search and rescue coordinators across the country. Crystal Dacey is a PhD candidate looking into the way we behave when we are lost in the wilderness. And Dr. Joe Kippax is an emergency doctor, the 2026 Tasmanian Australian of the Year, which was awarded for his role as part of a specialist team that rescued a whitewater rafter trapped in rapids on Tasmania's Franklin River. And Jim mentioned AMSA before. That stands for the Australian Maritime Safety Authority, the national body for coordinating search and rescue like this. And thank you for your texts. One person says, I drove around logging roads in northern New South Wales, lost for so many hours in the 90s with some friends. We thought we would run out of fuel and never be found. Locator beacons and mobiles are game changers. Another, family adventure in Japan with my analog illiterate parents. Lost mum to closing train doors. Spent 4 hours looking for her, coordinating with local train staff and the Australian Embassy. She found her way back to the station. We took the next train to the next stop. Assumed she would get off at the next stop. She made her way back. We underestimated her ability to find her way back. Wild experience. We now travel with air trackers, which just goes to show you can get lost in cities as well as in the wilderness. Regardless, have a plan with the people that you're with and that you love. And if you were inspired by Dr. Joe Kippax's story, the program Australian Story actually did an incredible piece on him and the rescue in the Franklin River. You can find that on ABC iView.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.